This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. Not sure where you're at in the U.S. and around the world. This is Baseball Outside the Box, and thanks for joining us. Hey, folks, first of all, I apologize. For the last couple of weeks, we've been having some shows that we already had taped before and putting them on. Hopefully, you've been enjoying them. We're currently live on Facebook, and the reason we've been doing that, and I'm going to dedicate this show to my mom, who passed away November 5th. God bless her, Italian. My mom and dad came over from Italy. If it wasn't for them, we would not be doing, my brother and I, what we do nowadays. They came here specifically for us to make sure we had a better life in the great country of the United States of America. So God bless my mom. She's in a better place with my dad. One day I will see her. So again, this show's dedicated to her. And of course, I want to thank everybody in the U.S. and around the world for joining us. We got a special show today. Let me tell you, one of the greats. This is going to be awesome. Not only one of the greatest pitchers in the game of baseball ever, but also one of the greatest guys and a no filter guy. Matter of fact, has a podcast called No Filter Sports Podcast. You got to go to it. Check it out. You know, you can Google it and find it right away. We'll put it on the show notes. Let me welcome. He needs no introduction, but think about it. 30-game winner, two Cy Young Awards, American League MVP, Most Valuable Player Award. We're going to talk about all this. He is outstanding. This is going to be a great show. Let me welcome the great Denny McClain. Denny, welcome to the show, my friend.
Peter, how are you, my friend?
Well, I'm doing good. I'm waiting for 2020 to end so we can get this misery over with.
This has been hell. This has been outrage. Any adjective you want to apply works. And yet on the other hand, it's been kind of a quick year. It hasn't been a slow down year, but it's been kind of a quick year. But everything happens more quickly. And I'm talking about the disasters, the deaths, the going over the limits right now with the COVID. It's just unbelievable. And I mean, I won't get into the politics of it at all, I promise you. But man, if people would just wear the mask, I just don't understand it. The mask, it's so harmless, but it is what it is. And people, you know, we live in a great country because you can be silly and not wear it. And of course, if you wear it, what a difference it makes, they say, in saves 20-25% of the lives that could be affected. I only hope that somebody comes around and kicks them in the butt. Let's go. Right.
You know, and we stressed on the show, we mentioned on the show many times, look, we've got to help each other. Wear the mask, wash your hands, keep your distance, and then we could still do things. It's not like, you know, I go to the gym, you know, I do my work. I go my wife goes to a grocery store. So it's not like we're asking you to stay home and hide.
Sure.
Obviously, if you've got illnesses, you've got to be really careful, even if you're wearing a mask. I mean, if you had major illnesses, I'd stay home no matter what. But other people, if they just follow that, I think we'd be all okay. So I think, but I got to ask you this because, you know, you've had an incredible career, not only on the field, but off the field. And you've been through so many things, ups and downs. This is definitely not one of your toughest times.
Oh, yes, it is. We talked before the show, I mean, I lost my wife a short time ago. That has been the most unbelievable event in my life, And we were married 51 years, loved every minute of it, every day of it. I'd do it all over again. Not to have her anymore in my life is really tough. I thought about a lot of things for 2 or 3 weeks after she passed. And I'm glad I didn't do any of them that I was thinking about. So, because there's a lot that we can still give back at our age. And if we're still relatively sharp, which I hope I am, that in fact we can contribute to something or someone. And I guess that's what we do now every day. We get up and we still work a little bit. We still have a couple of laughs every day. But boy, it's getting tougher and tougher. And I only hope that these medicines that they say they now have, two of them, are going to be the two big bullets that start to put our country back on the right path.
Absolutely. And I always try to look at, and by the way, you know, God bless and rest in peace, your wife, matter of fact, the daughter of Lou Boudreaux.
Right.
I remember you talking to her, talking about her many times. You know, during our shows, we also tell people, I think there's some positives, you know, that can come out with some of this. You know, I'm a big health person. You know, I'm a person that, you know, I walk every day, I run every day, I exercise every day, I drink water, I sleep. I'm not perfect, but I take vitamins, I do as much as I can. And I'm hoping that during these times, people realize how important your health is and your immune system.
Yeah.
And, you know, because without health, we have nothing.
That's right. And I have a heart condition. I've got, I'm in AFib all the time. I've been in AFib for 27 years. My doctor says, I don't know what the hell you're still alive for. He says, 27 years of AFib. That's a lot of AFib.
Wow.
And, he said, he says, you know how to handle it. So just go from there. It makes you 5 to 10 times more of a chance of having a stroke is the heart condition that I have. So, I've been able to manage it for 27 years, didn't realize it for the first 15. And, lo and behold, I've had some great doctors up here in Detroit at, one of the great hospitals up here. And, you know, one day at a time. I mean, that's my whole life right now is one day at a time. I've still got my kids running around, three of the four anyway, and my daughter, Michelle, and my boys, Denny and Timmy. And they're still doing very, very, very well. And I thank God for that. I lost my oldest daughter, of course, years ago when a drunken truck driver drove over her car.
Wow.
And that was kind of a bad day, too, to say the least.
Wow.
But, we've had a couple of shots, a couple of blows, but you know what? I've learned one thing, especially after this thing with Sharon, you got to get up the next day and you got to figure out what to do, because it will give you an opportunity to do some nice things.
You know, Denny, I think that's why it's important that you're on the show, is because somebody who's been through everything you've been through, from the positive and negative, can really give a lot back, not just to the game of baseball, but to people in general. And one of the things is interesting is, you know, you started off at a young career. I believe you went to Mount Carmel High School in Chicago, right? Was pitcher, shortstop. You got drafted out of high school. You know, you've been through everything when it comes to, you know, signing. It'd be interesting to get your take on when you first started, you know, what got you to the big leagues? What, you know, was it just your talent? Was it a mental part? What was the factor of getting you to the big leagues at such a young age?
Well, my dad was a big influence in my life. He died when I was 13. He had a heart attack, believe it or not. And lo and behold, the one thing he taught me as we were going through Little League was, listen, the harder you work and the further you go, the harder you must work. And that set in many years ago, and it set in, I think, the week he said it, because it was so profound at the time, not realizing it, of course, but I realized exactly what he meant exactly when he said it, and what he essentially said, and this really applied in the big leagues. Once you get there, if you wind up in a major league team, you won't believe how hard you've got to work once you get there, because everybody from the major league team down, and a lot of them on the team, want your job, period. And if you're going to stay there, you got to stay healthy. You got to do what you got to do to stay there. And the most important thing is you got to just have a good, good diet. So my dad preached that pretty good. So I think that's part of it. I've never had a cigarette in my life. I've never had a cigar in my life. I've never had what you would call an alcoholic bout. I've had a drink the night we won the pennant. I certainly had a drink. In fact, it took me 45 minutes to open up the damn bottle of champagne. literally 45 minutes. I almost cut my finger off. And here we're going into the World Series, and I'm playing with a knife trying to take the top of the damn champagne bottle off. And all of a sudden, I get all kinds of help. They got this on video for like an hour and a half, me. And they keep coming back to me when I'm trying to get this cork off. And finally, I got it off. And of course, as you know, what champagne does when it comes off after it's been bounced around a lot,
yep.
I probably got to drink about an ounce of it. But let me tell you one cute story that happened. After the celebration in the clubhouse, and all the guys were there, of course, Kaline and Cash and McCullough and Ray Euler, Bill Freehand, 12-time All-Star, who is still not in the Hall of Fame, Willie Horton, Gates Brown, as I said, Kaline and Jimmy Northrup. When we decided what we were going to do after the game, somebody said they're having a party at the townhouse in Detroit. That was one of those good restaurants, a lot of entertainment, and I mean in more ways than one. And so we drove out to Dearborn, and meanwhile I'm drinking all this damn champagne. I've got the flu, by the way, that day too. So I was pretty sick during the whole ball game. In fact, I laid down in the trainer's room for about four innings. And so anyway, we get in the car. There's four or five of us driving all the way out to Dearborn, and we park out there, and I wake up. I passed out. I woke up at 6:30 in the morning in front of the Detroit townhouse on Michigan Avenue. And anybody listening to the show locally, they'll know what I'm talking about. This was the place at 2:30, 3:30 in the morning. And lo and behold, I woke up at 6:30, and I looked up in the front and the back seat. Remember, I'm laying on the floor. And I looked up, and the first thing I saw was a woman who looked just like Saddam Hussein. Now, if you want to have the poop scared out of you, wake up and think you got Saddam Hussein in the back seat with you. I mean, that was, it just put pimples all over my back. I'm telling you, I said, what the hell is this, Norman? Cash was there. Freehand was there. Northrup. And apparently they had gone in and partied all night, and I just slept on the floor for 4.5 hours because I was pooped. I was done. I was, forget it. You weren't going to wake me up for a couple of more days. So that's how we started the celebration for the Detroit Tigers in 1968.
Wow. Unbelievable. You know, one of the things you mentioned and that was interesting, you know, my wife went through a similar thing. Her mom died when she was 13. Mm-hmm. You know, and adversity at a young age, it seems like really wakes you up and puts you in a direction. Could either bring you really down, or you can step up to the plate and kind of help you decide what you're going to do in your life. Was there a time where you just said, this is going to be tough. I'm going to give up. I just can't do this anymore.
Not really. I'll tell you what happened. My dad had made arrangements. He got me a full scholarship to Mount Carmel, and it was costing about $1,100 or $1,200 a year back then. That was a lot of money back then, ton of money. And this father, Austin Coop, who was the baseball guy, said, we don't give many scholarships out here except for football guys. He said, so you're one of the few that'll ever have a contract to play for no cost to you at all. So you'll be the guy. He said, we'll build our team around you. So one way or the other, and I talked to Weber, I talked to Mendel, I talked to St. Joe. We talked to all the schools at that time. And the best one that finally came out was Mount Carmel, despite the fact we had to play in Jackson Park. So make a long story short, we go in there. We have great success the 4 years I played there. We won the state, I think, once, and the city two or three times. And it was one of those learning things that I always remembered what my dad said. When you get there, you got to work harder and don't throw any curveballs. No curveballs until somebody gets a hold of you and shows you how to throw a real curveball, which I think we all agree that it's very difficult to throw. And it takes professionals to really show you how to do it the right way. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I went to Carmel, won a lot of ball games, had a lot of fun. In fact, my junior year, I led the city in hitting. I hit 601. I couldn't believe it. But nonetheless, that happened. We won the city, of course. But the education that I got at Mount Carmel – regardless of some of the problems I had in my life, was so instrumental in the way I ran my life. I didn't run my life badly at all. Everything I have today, I have because of baseball. Baseball has been so good to me. The Hammond Company, Hammond Organ Piano Company, were great to me. The Pepsi Company were great to me. They were just all wonderful. And if it wasn't for my ability to play ball, I don't know what we would have done, because my mom all of a sudden is 38 years old, and lo and behold, she just lost her husband. What do we do? Wow. So once a couple of years later, once I signed the contract, we paid off that. Listen to this now. I got $17,500 for my signing bonus, which was a decent sum of money at that time. Yep. And with the $17,500, we paid off our house, paid off our car,
wow,
and bought lots of groceries. And I still had, I bought two cars also, two Le Mans convertibles for $17,500. I had about $1,000 left. And I went out and bought shirts and pants and what have you. And then I had met Sharon Boudreau, and I was going to take her to dinner. And the night I was going to take her to dinner, I didn't have $4 in my pocket. I said, would you loan me $20? Because I knew Miss Boudreau would have some shekels on her. I can tell you that.
That's when you knew she was the right lady for you.
Yep, sure did. The minute I saw her, I knew I was going to marry her somehow, some way. You know, I don't know if you know this, and you'll remember this name. Kenny Hubbs, she was engaged to when died. Yeah, when he drove the plane into the mountain. So, you know, everybody has a bad day once in a while. That was terrible, just because Kenny Hubbs in his first year won Rookie of the Year for the Cubs. And we were all excited for Kenny Hubbs. We loved Kenny. I was the biggest Cub fan in the world at the time, as well as my mother and my dad. And we just had a great time with our Cubs. We never won. I mean, we never won. I mean, you talk about never winning.
Right.
I mean, that ball club was almost as bad as the Detroit Lions. They never win either. So that's kind of where we were at the age of 18.
Well, Denny, you know, that young, growing up in the game and, you know, developing, there had to be people along the way that, you know, kind of gave you advice, helped you with certain situations. Maybe talk about some of the people that were influential in your life and how they helped you.
Well, the biggest guy, besides my dad, and then he died, but the guy that brought more to the table for me than anybody else was Father Austin Koop. He was the baseball coach. I think he was assistant athletic director too. He was one hell of a man. He was 6'7½" and weighed 280. He was built like a brick, you know what, house. And I'm telling you, the man could do anything you wanted him to do. He would just test you all the time with different crazy things. But if he knew he had a good player, boy, I really learned this a lot in my sophomore, junior year. Boy, if you're a good player, it's amazing the difference how you're taken care of as a good player versus a mediocre player. And I learned an awful lot about myself those couple of years. And that is a education all by itself. I call it Denny McLean 101. And if you listen to 10 minutes of my spiel, I think you'll understand what the difference is to be a good player and how you get to be a better player, and a good player getting to be a great player. So it's in front of you. You just got to work, and you got to work harder than you've ever thought about in your life.
And folks, so you know, it was a pleasure, you know, meeting Denny. We had coffee one time. He came out to see me, which he came out my area. I think he was doing a show at the time. But then I listened to him speak at some banquets. What a great banquet speaker. And if we get, hopefully, this virus over with, you got to get Denny out to your banquets, man. He's awesome. You know, the other part of this is, you know, your first time in the big leagues, your first time pitching in the big leagues. What was that like, and how did you deal with the pressure behind it, especially because, you know, kids in general have to deal with pressure at all levels of the game. How did you deal with it?
Well, the way I dealt with it, I was 19 when they called me up to the big leagues. I got to pitch in September of 63. The second time up in the ballgame, by the way, we played against the Chicago White Sox my first game. by the way, the White Sox are the ones that signed me to my first contract. And then because of some crazy rules that they had in place back then, they could only keep one of the three youngest players on the team. The three youngest players on our team were Denny McClain, Dave DeBuscher.
Oh, yeah.
And Dave was an All-American at everything he did and an All-Star. And then a guy named Bruce Howard, who was a college sophomore, junior, and had a nice little curveball slider, whatever it was. But so those two guys were ahead of me. DeBuscher had a great fastball. I mean, I thought I had one too. And then DeBuscher had just, if he ever learned how to make the ball move, DeBuscher would have won 5,000 games. They threw the ball harder than any human being I've ever seen. And I mean it. Harder than anybody. I saw McDowell pitch. I saw the right-hander from Texas pitch. I saw the right-hander from Boston pitch, Clemens. All of those guys I saw pitch, and I'm telling you, DeBuscher threw the ball harder than any of those guys, and I'll tell you why. First of all, he was about 6'7 or 6'8, so he had all that height going for him. He had all those legs going for him, and by the time he let the ball go from the mound, he was only about 50 feet to home plate. So yep. He picked up 5 or 6 feet of a fastball. Just think about that. Pitching from 55 feet rather than 60 feet. You are just owning the hitters. The problem with David was his fastball was as straight as a string, and Molly Putz could go up there and hit it. I mean, he was, may have thrown the ball at 103, 104, but Molly was going to take her turn, and she was going to whip his ass because there is no way that you a guy could go in the big leagues without any movement on his fastball and expect to win. That was David's downfall. And of course, downfall in a sense, because he wound up being the president of the New York Knicks. And number two, not only the president of New York Knicks, but he was all everything in the NBA. And certainly his career, everything he did in his life was perfect. So he was one of those guys that we really all liked.
Absolutely. You know, one amazing thing, I don't believe you didn't have any injuries in your career, did you?
Well, I had to retire because of my rotator cuff. I finally started to tear my rotator cuff in 66. And then finally, it popped totally sometime in late 71. That's when it really became a real serious matter. But up till then, I had five pretty good years, won 108 or 110 games in 5 years. And lo and behold, all of a sudden woke up one morning and I couldn't put my arm over the top. I could not throw a fastball. And then the rest from there just got worse and worse and worse. And the pain was substantial. Just the pain was unbelievable. When we had a legal situation with the ball club, and they counted 212 cortisone shots that I had in my career, 212. Wow. And it is just phenomenal that I even have an arm left. That's what the one guy told me. He says, how many shots? And I said, somewhere around 200. He says, no, nobody gets 200. I said, listen, I'm it. So the next thing they found out, he says, my God, you had 212. He says, I don't know how they can do that. I said, well, they did it. It's over with. Now let's go find something to eat. Because yeah. at that point in time, how are you going to eat, right? You got to still live.
And, you know, I'm looking at 1968, 336 innings, 28 complete games. I mean, these are, you know, stats that you're never going to see again ever in a game of baseball. What did you guys do? What did you do specifically to recover? I mean, because, you know, you're throwing a lot of, you know, you're throwing a complete game. The next day, was there something you did to recover the next couple of days to help you pitch your next start?
Yeah, I threw every day. I threw every day. Johnny Sain was the guy that changed me a little bit. I had already won 16, 20, and I think, and then 17. So I had three pretty good years in a row. And then 68 came around. But before that happened, Johnny Sain took me out in the bullpen. And they took me out in the bullpen many times. He and Hal Narragon, that was our pitching coaches. And they took me out there this one night in Washington. We got rained out. And they said, why don't you work on that Johnny Sain little swiver? And I said, okay, let's go play. So we went out and I threw for an hour and a half. Wow. And the last 10 pitches I threw were the best sliders and we called it a slurve, but it was the best slider I ever threw, and I was throwing it at 90 miles an hour. So we're talking about a real serious fastball that looked like a fastball, but actually was a slider. That, and my slider would disappear with 4 or 5 inches. It would go straight down, and then it would move off the side of the plate. So whatever I did, and I never figured it out. I mean, I said, geez, as long as I got this, I'm not going to even try to figure it out. Right. So Johnny Sain tried to figure it out. Everybody tried to figure it out. Those were the days when everybody started talking about a backup slider. Nobody can throw a backup slider. The backup slider is just one of those anomalies. That's exactly what it is. You can't go out there and teach a kid how to throw a backup slider. If he throws a backup slider, it's because of a natural thing. And I'll guarantee you one thing. You won't win a lot of games with a backup slider.
Hmm. You know, also the other part of that is that, if I was reading correctly, Johnny Sain talked about the psychology. He helped you with the mental aspect of it. What were some of the things he told you, especially in dealing, I guess, in situations where, you know, you just gave up a couple runs? How do you deal with it mentally? How do you get back into the next pitch and preparing for the next pitch and not worried about what just happened?
John had a very strict operation. What he did was he taught us how a pitcher pitches. In other words, and this seems like a thing that you would just believe would be taken every moment of every player's career. It wasn't. We were given the ball and said, go out and get us 7-8 innings. Give us a full game tonight. Give us 9 innings. Give us this, this, and this. Never telling us how to do this, this, or this. And when Sain taught me this slider, I just thought I was walking on water. I mean, this pitch, I mean, I just couldn't believe what a difference it had made in my entire game, in the sense that I could throw this damn thing 9 out of 10 times for a strike. And now remember, 9 out of 10 times for a strike at 90 miles an hour, that is an effective pitch, folks. I mean, that's a big league pitch. And what I didn't realize was all the damage I was doing to my rotator cuff, and it just got worse and worse and worse. But the bottom line to the pitch was I could do it anytime I wanted. And Sain, and I'm going to tell you now, the secret to pitching, and people out there, most of them, 50% probably won't listen anyway, but I'm going to tell you the secret to pitching per Johnny Sain, and I can confirm it, folks. I won 30 ball games, so I got pretty good credentials to tell you. And the next year, I won 24 after I won the 30. So we were on a pretty good roll until my rotator cuff went. Anyway, this is the way John taught us how to pitch. If we were behind with a hitter, behind 2-0, 2-1, 3-1, that was the time you throw the breaking ball. Now, once you learn how to effectively control it, that's when you started to throw it. It's because it's a real simple pitch to throw strikes with. And the velocity is what determines how good it's going to be. Now, if I have got a guy 0-2, why make him chase a pitch? You got him 0-2, no balls and 2 strikes. Think about that. Why would you throw him a changeup? Why would you throw him something that you can hang? You can't hang that fastball. You might throw it in the wrong place, but you can't hang that fastball. You get a guy 0-2. Johnny Sain once said, you got a guy 0-2. Now he's your sucker. That's your sucker. You can do anything to him you want as long as it's a fastball. And I pitched like that for the next 3 years with that philosophy. And I won a lot of games, won 17, 31, and 24. And then I got hurt. But the theory, and it's short theory, the extensiveness of getting it well done is where the test comes in, because you're not going to go out there one night and figure this out. You're not going to understand it. You're going to understand the philosophy of when you are behind in the count, you can throw the pitch. If you're not behind in the count, throw the fastball. If you're even 2-2, it's a good place to throw a changeup. It's a good place to throw a slow curveball, something like that. But the philosophy is very short. It's the extensive amount of time it takes to get there.
Now, even when you play in the big leagues, you know, the you had a plan going in because you guys knew the hitters pretty much because you played against them quite a bit. When you had that game, kind of talk about how you, what kind of game plan you had for certain hitters and who made that decision. You know, obviously you've got the ball. What happens if your catcher and you aren't exactly on that same page on that one pitch? You had final decision?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's always going to be the pitcher's decision. I know today the managers like to call signs for whatever reason. The pitcher knows what good his stuff is that day. He knows if his curveball is better than his slider, if his slider is better than his fastball. You got to let these kids pitch. If you don't let them pitch and do their shtick, they are never going to learn how to pitch. And this entire league that we call the major leagues is going to wind up with a starter going 3 and 4 innings, period. And that's what I'm afraid of. That's where we're at right now. Yeah. And I mean, if we don't do something to make the pitcher more effective, and somebody said, well, they're throwing so hard. They may be throwing hard, but they're not throwing any harder than we did. That's number one. I mean, we had Sam McDowell and Louis Tion and all these guys that could throw the ball through the wall. But you know what? Our guys pitched. Our guys threw strikes. Why were our games 2 hours and 15 minutes, and theirs are all at 3.5? I mean, almost every game is at least 3.5. It's because we did one thing, guys. We threw the first pitch for a strike. We all tried to throw the first pitch for a strike. That's what made the game quicker. That's what made the game in a way that we were able to get home before the moon came out later on the next day. So it was all kinds of benefits, but you had to be ahead of the hitter because the successful way you win is by throwing a couple of strikes and throwing them often, because you can't mess around. Listen, these are big league hitters. You're going to make a mistake, you're going to probably pay for it. You're going to throw a fastball down the middle, you're going to blow it up. But if you got a guy 0-2, you got a guy 1-2, and you can make a mistake with a fastball and still get a guy out. You can't make many mistakes with a hanging curveball or a hanging slider and get the guy out. I think we all know that.
You know, and that's something interesting because watching the World Series, you know, I love the Rays. You know, I mean, they've done a great
job. Yeah, I do too.
Low payroll. But there were times where sometimes, and again, I'm not the expert here, but there were times where I'm thinking, man, why are you trying to hit the corners all the time?
Yeah.
Guy once in a while. You got a 98-mile-an-hour fastball. Use it. I mean, you should have decent location. You've been pitching for a while. So why not use that fastball a little bit more?
In their defense a little bit, you know, they don't leave them in the minor leagues long enough. They don't let them have that extra year and a half. That's a big mistake. But here's baseball. They make $1 billion a year, and they're trying to cut back right now. And I know we've all had a bad year this year, 2020. But that doesn't mean you got to change the whole game. It doesn't mean that your pitcher should only pitch 3 innings. It doesn't mean that you should steal second base. It doesn't mean any of that. You still got to play the game. They're still playing the game with a glove, a ball, and a bat. And until they take that stuff away, play the game of baseball. You're going to be so further ahead than anybody else. You just won't believe it. And if you're throwing strikes, and I mean strikes, and they don't have to be on the corner, just like Peter just said. I'm sorry, Peter. And bottom line is, Peter is 100% right. You don't have to make perfect pitches when you got a guy 0-2 and 1-2. Folks, he's your sucker at that point in time. Throw a strike, and you'd be surprised how easy the game can become.
And that was the difference to me when I saw the left-handed pitcher in game 6 of the World Series. He was attacking the hitters at that time. His prior start, it seemed like he was nibbling a lot. Now he's up to 90 pitches in four innings. And that's what I want to get to, is because during your time, there didn't seem to be as many injuries that there are now. Now, our experts are saying the injuries are coming because they throw harder.
No,
maybe we have more pitchers that throw harder. There's maybe more numbers. I don't know.
Well, we got more players.
Yeah. Okay. What do you attribute the injuries to, and how do we stop slow down these injuries?
Well, one of the reasons is that they don't throw enough. That's number one. They just don't throw enough. If they want to stop this stampede of injuries, especially for pitchers, these guys are going to have to sit down one day. It's a rules committee, if there is such a thing, this rules committee, and raise the mound back to 16 inches. Put the mound where it was. Let the game start to get even again. Because the game right now is lopsided in the player's favor, the hitter's favor. So you guys got to back up, take a look at it. And I know if they sit down long enough and look at it, that they will make the right decision and raise the mound. Maybe it doesn't have to go to 16, but maybe it's got to go to 12 or 13 or 14 maybe. But whatever it is, there's a magic number out there that will get the game on a more even level, and everybody can play and everybody can have some success at times, sometimes not. But the bottom line is strikes, and more strikes. And if you quit screwing around, we got a kid by the name of Casey Mize. They gave him $8 million, and he hasn't got Molly Putz out yet. I mean, he hasn't gone – he's barely got into the fourth inning one time. I think he's the longest stint he had is 4 1/3 innings. Keep this in mind, $8 million, and the kid is – his longest appearance was 4 1/3 innings. All the other appearances were less than 4 1/3. Think about that, less than 4 1/3. And, I mean, they lit him up. They lit him up like it's the 4th of July about every other pitch. He just got rack attacked like I couldn't believe. And I know I think he went to winter ball either in Arizona or some other place, but he needs to stay in winter ball for about two winters. I know why he won so many games in college now. None of us could believe how many games he won in college. Well, guess what? In college, which is like a Class D minor league, right? I think we all agree with that. Class D minor league. If you throw the Class D minor leaguer a curveball and a slider and get it for a strike once in a while, you're going to win a lot of games in college. They've never seen a curveball or a slider of any effectiveness. They've never seen any of that. So now he goes to the big leagues with his curveball and slider, and what happens? We thought he had a fastball. There was no fastball. The guy's right. Throwing 90 miles an hour. I'm thinking, hell, I think if I get my arm fixed, I can do 90, for God's sakes. And I've been a little tough on the kid too with our show. But you know what? He hasn't learned a thing since he arrived. And I get so damn tired when they say, boy, our team's right on track to do some great things. My Lord, they're giving up 10 runs a game. I mean, the one good thing about it, when you're giving up 9 and 10 runs a game, your pitchers are going to be in great shape by the end of the year because all they're going to be doing is backing up third and home, running like hell.
Hey, you know, you bring up a good point. They are bringing some of these guys up fairly young, not enough experience. I agree with you 100% there. Now, what would Denny McClain, and I appreciate your time here, Denny, so we're coming close to the end, but what would Denny McClain, if he was pitching now, what would he change learning everything you learned from the past?
Oh, man.
If he would change something.
Yeah, I was thinking I throw more breaking balls, but that wasn't my bread and butter. My bread and butter was my fastball, period. Yeah. I used to throw 80% fastballs almost every game, 80, sometimes 90. If I really had the ball, rising.
Would you change anything in your, mechanics or your,
I probably would go back to my, better windup. I had a big windup at one time. And I think when I went to the shorter windup where you just have that short little turn on the mound before you throw the ball, I think that took away some miles per hour on my fastball. I always thought that because, and I'll tell you why, when they reduced the mound from 16 to 10 or 11, whatever it was, I had the year before when I won 30, I struck out 280 guys. The year that I win 24, the next year, you're not going to believe this, I only struck out 180, 100 less guys struck out with me than more. So my point being this, and by the way, I set a record that year for Tiger shutouts. I threw 9 shutouts in one season in 1969. So you try to figure it out for me because I can't figure it out. So I set a record for shutouts. I win 24 ball games. I win the Cy Young again. And then lo and behold, I strike out 100 men less. So, but my control got so much better in 68. And then by the time 68 rolled around towards the end of the season, I'm telling you, I could pitch with my eyes closed. That's how comfortable I was on the mound.
Now, you were also hired as a pitching coach. Was that with Detroit?
Johnny Sain, yeah.
Yeah, so during that time, because when you think about it, you know, I'm thinking nowadays, you know, you've got some pitchers, quite a few pitchers now that go from the stretch. They don't go from the windup at all.
Yeah, right.
They're trying to minimize things as far as, you know, mistakes.
Yeah, they're trying to have less movement.
Yeah, but at the same time, when you have movement, man, there's rhythm, there's tempo, there's, you know, I mean, there's a lot. I just think it feels better when you have a windup, but I guess times have changed when it comes to that.
Peter, there's one thing. These guys who have decided to abandon the windup, now pitching in a stretch, are walking more guys than they've ever walked. Just take a look at the stats. They're walking. They're behind 2-0, 3-1 all the time. These 3.5-hour games, you know, listen, the 3.5-hour game is the norm now. It's not, you know, and you know what's funny about that? And we kind of juggle laugh at this once in a while. If you're a fan, let's say you're a Detroit Tiger fan in Detroit, and you just won 14-0, and the game was 3.5 hours. The Tiger fans are super happy. The only fans that are upset are the guys on the other side. So when they come back to the park tomorrow, and the Baltimore Orioles win 14-0, the Tigers now are all upset, and they're upset because the game is so long. Well, hell, if you don't give up 14 runs, it doesn't wind up being so long. So, I mean, it's amazing how the personalities of the people come out for different things. You know, if you win, I'm in a better mood, right? If I lose, I'm going to be pissed.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'd love to get your opinion on this, because now we have in the big leagues, you know, where relievers have to pitch the 3 batters.
Oh, my God.
You know, they're also thinking, and I think they're just overthinking a lot of this. They're thinking because – you know, guys aren't stealing enough. Now, all of a sudden, they might even bring in a rule where, you know, you have to step off the mound before you can pick off.
Yeah.
I want to get your thoughts on all that. What do you think about the state of the game right now? And what would you not do or change?
I'll tell you a quick story about 3 batters. I was playing against the Boston Red Sox, first inning, nobody out. And I had walked a guy, I had hit a guy, and an infield single. Bases loaded. I'd thrown only about 10 or 11 pitches. That's all I'd thrown. And Bill Freehand comes out to the mound, my catcher. And again, 12-time All-Star, not in the Hall of Fame. So he comes, he says, "What's the matter?" I said, "What do you mean, what's the matter?" I said, "Boy, you're missing a hell of a game if you're not watching." He says, "What the hell do you mean?" He says, "Hey, don't look. Here comes Mayo. He says, "I swear he's going to take you out." I said, "He doesn't have the balls to take me. I've just pitched 300 innings for him, for God's sakes. You think he's really going to take me out?" He says, "I'm telling you, look at him. He's smoking. He's running out here." I says, "Mayo hasn't run in 25 years. And I turned around, and there he was running across the line. He was trying to prevent me from throwing another pitch. So he comes to the mound. And he starts talking to me, "Give me the ball, give me the ball, give me the ball." I said, "No, I'm not giving you the ball." I said, "Why would I give you the ball?" I said, "I want to pitch to at least one or two more hitters." He says, "What?" He says, "You got Boog Powell up, and Powell hits you like 500. He does. Boog Powell used to just tear me apart. He used to kill me. He used to make my ass so sore covering up third, I can't tell you. And he hits 5-something against me as a player. And so here Mayo is standing there and screaming at me and calling me not nice names. And he says, "I want the damn ball. Give me the damn ball." All he had to do was turn around to the home plate umpire and say, "Here, give me a new ball." That's all they had to do.
Right.
But I had him so upset, he didn't even think about another ball. So he's going crazy out there. He's MFing this, and he's MFing that, and he's MFing this, and doing that. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. You tell me how your stuff is today." I said, "No, that's unfair." I says, "Come on, ask Freehand how my stuff is." turned to Freehand, and he says, I don't know if that's right. I says, it's right. You ask Freehand how my stuff is today. You'll be surprised. And Freehand got this little smirk on his face, and Mayo said to him, how's McLean's stuff today? Tell him the truth. He says, how the goddamn hell would I know? I haven't caught anything yet.
You gotta love it. Yeah. You know, imagine that right nowadays with, you know, especially like in game six, if the left-hander would have told us, you know, Cash, hey, I'm not coming out.
Yeah.
Because he didn't look too happy about coming out.
No, he was, you know, that you're right. And the other time, the left-hander with the Dodgers too, Ken Kershaw, they took him out when he shouldn't have come out of a ball game. And then they lost the game. But you know, the problem is they're overmanaging. These managers they want to be seen. They not only want to manage, they want to be seen. They want to be the guy on the field. You know, a good manager, a super manager, Mayo Smith used to say this, Charlie Dressen, who I played 4 years ago, Charlie said the same thing. He said, a good manager only makes a difference in about 7 to 8, maybe 9 games a year. That's all. Otherwise, the ball is the ball, the bat is the bat, and the glove is the glove. He says, you can't get around those three things. It's impossible.
Absolutely. Denny, last thing, and I really, like I said, appreciate your time here.
My pleasure.
You know, as far as some of the guys you face, some of the toughest hitters, how did you deal with them as far as, you know, how did you pitch to them? Let's put it that way. I know situations dictate whether it was running on base and all that. But in general, when you did face a Boot Powell, what was your game plan against them? Say there was nobody on base and you were pitching to them and you weren't going to walk them, but you wanted to go, you know, you wanted to try to get them out, hopefully.
Oh, you know what? I got to finish the story. I forgot to finish the Boog Powell story.
Yep.
What happened was I threw him a good fastball. I really was trying to jam him real bad because I had him. This was the first pitch of his hitting with the bases loaded. And guess what he did? Hit a line drive right back at me. I threw to Euler at second, and the Euler threw it to Cash at first. We had a triple play. How about that? And wait a minute. We win 7-3.
Wow.
Yeah, what a game, huh? But the philosophy, I forgot the question. But
no, as far as pitching to hitters, the tough hitters.
Okay. Yeah. This is part of the Johnny Sain colloquy, and what essentially says is first of all, once you get behind, you got to be more protective. What was the question again? I'm sorry.
Well, your game plan.
Oh, okay. And Johnny Sain, parts of his philosophy had this, and this is the toughest one to work. You never ever allowed the best hitter on the team to beat you. Mm-hmm. Even if you had to walk him. Now, you don't walk a guy to force in a run. You never do that, but you don't have to give them a grand slam home run. You could intentionally walk them somehow, some way, and keep the bases, you know, give up one run versus four. And Johnny always said, and that's essentially what he tried to bear down on you with, do not let the best hitter on the team beat you. Do not. And so that's, and what that forces you to do is that you will throw more strikes knowing you, first of all, you got a couple of men on base. So it's going to force you to bear down a little bit and throw more strikes. That's exactly what it's going to do. Mentally, it's compelling you to throw strikes, whether it's a fastball, curveball, slider, but that's what it is. And then you got to determine the hitter, whoever he is, what can he hit a curveball better than a fastball, slider, whatever. But, and you know, you only learn that stuff once you see a guy a couple of times. And in today's game, the shift, and I, ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for the shift. The shift is partially my family's fault, Mr. Boudreau, because Lou Boudreau is the one that started the shift with Ted Williams. The first shift ever done was Ted Williams, the shift against Cleveland. And Lou was the manager then when he did it the first time. And they got Ted out the first time. Ted was peeved, boy. They said Ted went nuclear. Why is that legal? How can that be legal? It's this and that. And he went nuts. He said in the locker room.
What did Ted do later on when they did put on the shift again? You know,
he would get his share of hits.
Yeah.
I mean, listen, Ted was so damn, and I played for him, by the way, in Washington for a year. Ted was so damn bullheaded that he would never, ever, ever try to hit the ball to left field. Never. You know, he was a left-handed hitter. He would never, ever, that bullheadedness of his probably cost him. I think he could have hit 500 if he'd played throwing the ball to left field. I swear he could, because I'm going to tell you, he was the best hitter I ever saw in spring training. The guy just hit one line drive. As a matter of fact, we had a guy in our club by the name of Pete Broberg, kid just out of college. The kid threw the ball as hard as any human being in the world. Okay. The problem was he had no idea where that ball was going. And if you're a hitter in spring training and it's 50 degrees out, you do not want to get in there with a Pete Broger who can't find home plate. In that cold, one broken bat, you are going to have to go to the hospital to get your hands fixed. But what he did was Pete Broberg slowed it down just a hair for Ted, and Ted hit it over the right field wall.
So is Denny McClain for outlawing the shift or for teaching young players early on to hit the ball all over the place?
No, I think they overdo it. That's all. I just believe too many teams are trying to be the next who was the great Casey Stengel. Everybody wants to be Casey Stengel or Tom with the Dodgers.
Lasorda.
Lasorda, Tommy, yeah, good man. You know, everybody wants to be in their shoes. Well, there's only one set of shoes for each of those guys, and you got to work real hard to get where they eventually got to. They were two superstars when it came to managing.
So if Denny McClain, speaking about managing, because, you know, as you know, I'm in Chicago. Tony La Russa will be managing the Chicago White Sox. There's been a lot of heat in Chicago. You know, a lot of fans don't like it. A lot of media don't like it. You know, luckily, I got a chance, you know, not like everybody else, but I got a chance to work with Tony in the World Baseball Classic.
Yeah, Tony's a good guy.
I met him. We sat down. I got to know him pretty decent. Yeah. And I really believe personally he's going to be able to handle the situation in Chicago. But my question is, if Denny McClain was managing in the big leagues, you're seeing more celebration, you know, by players, whether it be hitting a home run, we now even saw a pitcher throw his head up in the air after he struck out a guy. How would you deal with those situations? Because times are changing, but at the same time, remember, if you go too far with it, where does it stop?
Yeah, that's right. I say this to you. There's two things I would do. Number one, you wear a shirt and tie every day to the ball game if you're on the road. On the road, shirt and tie, 100%. We got to put in some kind of discipline if we're going to – and the little things become real serious discipline from time to time. And then as far as the game goes – the hitters just got to be ready to play. They have to practice. They have to show up for batting practice. I mean, I hear stories all the time. And when I'm down to Tiger Stadium, I see these guys who don't even take batting practice anymore. They take three swings and they're done. I mean, why? I mean, you can go in there and hit for 15 minutes, for God's sakes. They got cages everywhere. I mean, I don't understand it.
They don't even take infield.
Huh?
They don't even take infield outfield.
They don't even take infield anymore. They don't take outfield anymore. I don't know. Sooner or later, they got to fix that. And I'm telling you, the only way they fix it is raise the mound again. They can make a big, big, big adjustment if they just raise the mound. It'll take a ton of stress off that shoulder. I'm telling you, it'll take a – because remember, my arm didn't go real bad until they reduced the mound. Remember that. Mm-hmm. I had 280 strikeouts the year before, and I had a lot of pain in 69 when I struck out only 180, 124. But the bottom line was the velocity wasn't there. I don't know how I had the shutouts. I have no idea how I won 24. We just did. We had a great club.
Wow, outstanding. Denny, this has been great. Can't thank you enough, man. We're going to end it here because – you know, yeah, I'd love to talk to you for 5 hours. I think this would be outstanding. Last thing, could Denny McClain manage in the big leagues nowadays with the statistics, with the shifts, with the type of players that play nowadays? And I'm not trying to downgrade the players. I'm just saying different type of players mentally wise.
I think you've got good communication skills. I think you can manage anybody and anything, as long as everybody understands what the rules are. And I think it's just like Sparky Anderson said. He said, I never put hard rules in, but I put rules in, and they knew that if they violated those, that that would be a problem with me, and they would probably be on the next train to Chattanooga. So he made it real clear, if you don't want to go along with what we're doing here and be in a part of our program that we want you to be in, then we're going to send you someplace that you may not like.
All right, Denny, tell everybody about your podcast, and then we'll close it
Our
off.
Our podcast is No Filter Sports Podcast. You just go online, go to Google, and just write that in, No Filter Sports Podcast, or go to DennyMcLean31.com, DennyMcLean31.com, and that takes you right to the website, which will give you a list of things, including the podcast. And we've had almost 200 interviews over the first 2 years. So if whoever it is, it's on there. Believe you me, there's 200 guys up there waiting to talk to you.
All right. Super. Denny, remember, folks, we're going to put it on the show notes. We'll put everything on there for you. Can't thank you enough. Mr. McLean, it was an honor. God bless you, man. Thanks for being on the show.
Peter, it's always good to see you. And if everybody, please stay safe. And lastly, please wear your mask, please.
Absolutely. Wear the mask, wash your hands, stay your distance, still get together with people, but just follow the rules. God bless.
Send me a couple Chicago hot dogs.
There you go. And we got to get a couple beefs too.
Chicago. Absolutely. Absolutely. Have a good one, guys.
All right, everybody, that's Denny McLean. I'm Pete Caliendo. This is Baseball Outside the Box. A special thanks to Brian Crock, our producer with the Lineup Media Group. Special thanks to everybody in the U.S. and around the world. And, of course, God bless my mom. Rest in peace. This show was dedicated to her and also Denny's wife, who passed away a year ago. So, again, everybody, stay safe, stay healthy. See you on the next show. Bye-bye.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm.